Well, good morning, everyone. For today's biography, we're going to hear the life story of a man that I actually knew nothing about prior to reading into his life. So hopefully we'll all learn something today. Now, our story begins in Scotland in the year 1824. And that's when John Gibson Paton was born. Now, he was born into quite a simple family. His father was a stocking maker, and his mother was a high-spirited Highlander woman by the name of Janet, who, in John's eyes, was truly heroic. You know, she raised 11 children, of which he was the eldest, and often managed the household on very, very little. Now, the parents were very strong Christians. And actually, they really taught their children really well in the scripture. When John was quite young, they moved to a little village called Torthwald in Scotland. And this particular village was known for its tailors and weavers and stocking makers and such like. And they had a thatched cottage there, which they lived in for a good 40-odd years. Now, the home was quite small. At one end was Mr. Paton's workshop, and the other end served as the rest of the family home. But there was a tiny room in the middle, which was known as the closet. And it was in here that Mr. Paton would retire every day to pray. And the children could hear every day him crying out for their souls. Now, when John Paton was 12 years old, he had to leave school and learn his father's trade, as was custom in those days. And it was very, very tough work back then. You know, their working hours were from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. And he was required to work all of those hours with a one-hour break in the middle of the day and half an hour for breakfast, half an hour for supper. But from this tender age, John had a desire to be a missionary. His parents were not missionaries. They didn't really know any missionaries, but he had a desire to be a missionary. And so he would spend his break times trying to study, because he knew if he was going to be a missionary, then he had work to do. He needed to have a good education. And to John, God's presence was very, very real. In the face of his parents, he could see, he understood who God was. And as a child, he came to know the Lord personally. He remembers certain incidents from his childhood. One particular incident was during the sort of like a potato famine. And at this time, the price of food was really high, and the family was really struggling. They were struggling to put every meal on the table. John's father ended up having to go and work in another town just to find some extra work to pay for the family, etc. And there was a day when they really ran out of food. And Mrs. Paton, she really didn't know what to do. She had 11 hungry children and nothing at all. But she called her children together and she said, we must pray and God will care for us. Well, sure enough, the very next day, there was a delivery of a bag of potatoes and a sack of flour and some homemade cheeses. It was sent by John's grandfather, who had no idea of their situation, but just felt prompted to send some food. But before the children could even eat, the mother gathered them around and said, "Oh, my children, love your Heavenly Father. Tell him in faith and prayer all your needs, and he will supply your wants as far as it shall be for your good and his glory." This significant incident made a huge impression on the young John. You know, he remembered that particular line, "He will supply your wants as far as it should be for your good and for his glory." Now, John soon applied for a training position in a seminary in Glasgow in Scotland. This would be the first step to becoming a missionary. But because his family was poor, he was applying for a position where he could get board and food and so on, but he would be expected to work sort of in payment for his training. Well, he did receive a letter saying that he was shortlisted. There were two candidates, and he had to go to Glasgow for an interview. Well, his parents were very supportive with this, although it meant leaving the village and moving into the big city. And he would have to walk 65 kilometres to the railway station just to get the train to Glasgow. His family couldn't afford a coach or anything like that. So 2 days before his train, he gathered all his personal belongings into a bundle, and the little village boy set off for the big city. Now, his father, Mr. Peyton, walked with his son for the first 10 or so kilometres. And along that way, he just counselled his son, gave him advice, and prayed aloud for his boy. But in that last half mile, they walked in complete silence. His father's lips moved ceaselessly in prayer, and his tears flowed freely. Finally, they stopped at a junction, and grasping his young son, the father said, "God bless you, my son. Your father's God prosper you and keep you from all evil." The old man was unable to speak any more, but he stood, clasping his hat in his hand, and watched as his eldest boy walked on. And it was at that point that John Peyton vowed deeply that by the help of God, he would live and act so as never to grieve and dishonour such a father and mother as God had given him. Now, the board of the seminary in Glasgow could not split these two candidates, and they were both equally deserving, and they only had £50 to spend on this for this position. And so they suggested to the two candidates that maybe they could both be successful. They would have to split the board, £25 each, but at least they could split the workload as well, and they would both get the training. This suited John and the other candidate perfectly, and they ended up becoming really good friends. They had to share the room, of course, and so on, and it was very, very difficult. And the board was a little bit meagre, which meant that they were often hungry and they didn't have enough heat and so on. And very soon, John Peyton was quite sick, coughing up blood and such like, and he was unable to continue. He had to return home to his parents, and it was a while before he could return to the city to start at college. But being from quite a poor family, he needed a job. He had to pay his way. His family couldn't afford just to send him to college. And it was tough work finding a job, but he ended up just walking past a shop window, and there was a little advertisement for a job as a teacher in the Maryhill Free Church School. He applied, and he got it straight away. He was warned when he got the job that the school was an absolute wreck. This was a free school, so it was for children of fairly poor families, and in this area the families were mainly coal miners and the mill workers. And the children who attended here, well, they were quite violent. And in fact, most of the teachers had left, and the reason there was a vacancy was because the teachers had left seriously injured or abused in some way. The minister handed John Peyton a heavy cane and said to use it freely and perhaps even in self-defence. And this was no exaggeration. The school was so difficult. And when the good-natured clerk kind of looked at John Peyton's benign, kind-looking face, he decided that he would attend the classes as well, only just to rescue John in case he was beaten up on the first day. Well, they underestimated John. John Peyton had quite a gift for children, and he could recognise when he came in front of this rabble, this class, that there was one key student who was clearly a ringleader. And this student just wanted to fight, and he had no intention of getting any sort of education. And so, on that first day, Peyton slammed the door shut and locked it, much to the clerk's distress. And he declared to this boy that it would either be he or him that leaves, because he was there for their education. Or this student lashed out at him and dived on him and was going to beat him up. And John Payton, I mean, it was different days back then, John Payton fought him off blow after blow, and the two of them were locked in battle until finally Payton got the upper hand and threw the boy into the chair. While the other students watched on, much subdued by all of this. And then Payton told them that he was going to put that cane away. He was going to educate them, not with terror, but with love. It took a while, but soon that cane was forgotten. And soon the classes grew, the school grew, the attendance increased. And now he had classes day and night. But actually, with all this success, he did himself out of a job. Because with the school growing, they needed a higher qualification of teacher. And John didn't have that qualification. And so again, he was on the road looking to where to move on. Now, by this time, he had heard of the Glasgow City Mission. This was a particular organisation that worked amongst the slums of Glasgow. And John, again, applied and was able to work here. He was quite gifted at this work. He ran Bible classes for young women and boys and offered practical help in the slums and so on. And there really was visible change amongst the people there. You know, this was clearly seen because the pub owners were in great opposition to this mission, to Payton and the other missionaries, because their profits had dropped considerably. Well, running these Bible classes gave Payton so much joy. But he didn't feel that this was where he was meant to be. In fact, he described it as like when he thought about his future, he would hear in his mind the wailing of the perishing. That's how he put it. And he could think of all those people who had actually never heard the gospel and had no opportunity to hear the gospel as well. And he could hear them almost crying as they perished. He knew that if he left the Glasgow City Mission, there would be other people who would be willing to take his place, other people who would step in. There would always be opportunity here. But there were people who had never heard and had no opportunity, and it was to them he was drawn. Now, this was certainly the case in the 1800s. In fact, in 1774, Captain Cook had just mapped the Pacific Islands. He called this group of islands the New Hebrides. Of course, now this chain of islands is called Vanuatu. And few people had ventured into these waters at all. I mean, even Captain Cook didn't stay there. The only people that had been there, really, were traders at this point, people who'd discovered sandalwood, and they would be able to cut the sandalwood and sell it and so on. And so, you know, this really was uncharted territory. And John was hearing about these things. You know, he knew that this was a new area of the world that had just been mapped. In fact, in 1839, two missionaries were sent to these islands in the New Hebrides, and they landed on an island called Eremango. And on Eremango, they made contact with the tribal people there, but they were clubbed to death and eaten by the cannibals on the island. So the other missionaries that had been there had either just escaped for their lives, or they had just managed to maybe make some sort of contact and flee. There had been very little work done in this whole area up to that day. The Reformed Presbyterian Church, of which John Payton was part and where he grew up and so on, had actually been advertising for a missionary to go and serve in these southern seas, as they called it. But no one had put their hand forward, perhaps understandably, considering what happened to the last two missionaries. John felt that he wanted to put his hand up. He wanted to do this work. But he also knew that he wasn't exactly qualified for it. But he felt, well, if no one else is offering, perhaps I should just offer myself. But then again, he had a really fruitful work in Glasgow as well. But he was drawn to the idea of going out to people who had never heard the gospel and had no access to it at all. Or Dr. Bates of the New Hebrides Mission praised God when he heard that John Payton was actually going to apply. Now, finally, there was somebody who was willing to go. But, you know, he had further study to do. He had to do some medical study and all sorts of things. But, of course, that could all be arranged. At least there was a willing heart. But actually, during this time, most people felt that John's decision was completely wrong. They said, "What are you doing? You've got this very fruitful work in Glasgow, and you're making such a difference here. People are turning to the Lord in these slums. You've made a huge difference in this community. You're turning your back on this?" In fact, there were only two people that were supportive: Dr. Bates of the New Hebrides Mission and John's parents, who had given him over to the Lord for his service long ago. Well, most people really tried to talk John out of it. They said that he was an adventure seeker, that he was being rash, that he hadn't thought things through. One elderly gentleman lectured John and said, and actually, you know, he was offered positions left, right and centre in Glasgow to stay. And this elderly man told him to rethink what he was doing was foolish. But John was quite clear that he would go. And this elderly gentleman exclaimed in exasperation, "But the cannibals! You'll be eaten by those cannibals!" And John replied, "Well, I confess to you that if I can but live and die serving and honouring the Lord Jesus, it will make no difference to me whether I'm eaten by cannibals or by worms." Well, in 1857, John, now 33 years old, was finally ordained. He'd done the required medical study, and he'd also been married. And he and his young wife set sail for the Pacific. They'd only been married a few weeks. First, they had to sail to Australia, and then from there they were to take a ship that was bound to Penang. And this, with sort of an arrangement with the ship's captain, this ship was just going to pull over to the southernmost tip of the New Hebrides, an island by the name of Aneityum. And there they would drop off John Payton and his wife and some of the others who were travelling there. There'd actually been quite fruitful work on this particular island. Just 10 years before, another missionary by the name of John Getty had been there. And he and another missionary had worked and hung on this island. And they had actually made quite a difference. And many people had been converted on this small island. So it kind of became a mission base. And they knew that they would be able to land there. Once John and his wife had settled in Aneityum, they decided that this wouldn't be where they stayed. They were going to be posted to another island. This was the island of Tanna. And here, they would try and negotiate with the chiefs of the island to hopefully buy some land, and there they would be able to build a mission house. But Tanna had an evil reputation. In fact, there had been some missionaries there sent from Samoa, and those missionaries had been killed and eaten, as was the practice in those days. You know, if you killed your enemy, you showed the complete defeat of the enemy by eating him. But the thing is, there were different sort of tribal groups on Tanna. There were the harbour chiefs, there were the inland chiefs, and so they still thought that there might be a way that they could perhaps set up a little mission base on Tanna and bring the gospel to this dark island. Well, white people were a bit of a curiosity. And on Tanna, the harbour chiefs saw their own benefit. There would be opportunity for lots of different things if there was a white person on the island. Firstly, there would be more supplies. They would have access to different knives. They would have gunpowder. There was all these sort of benefits of having a white person on the island. And so actually the chiefs agreed to sell some land to John Payton, or the mission organisation. And so John and his wife were able to base themselves on Tanna. This was a very violent island. There was conflict between the tribes constantly. And the people of the tribe, they worshipped idols. There was also a lot of witchcraft and such like. And the chiefs themselves were seen as sacred men. Many of them were revered and very much feared as well. They certainly had a strong belief in evil spirits. And John realized very quickly that on this island there was no concept of a God of mercy. There was no concept of grace, forgiveness, nothing like this. Everything on this island was driven by fear, revenge, violence, anger, retaliation, and the cycle just went on. Life was very, very difficult on Tanna. Firstly, of course, they had to learn the language. Now, some Anyechimese people had come over with them to help them in this, to help them understand the culture, to help them understand the language. And these Anyechimese believers were such a help to John and his wife Mary at this time. But they also had to build a house with the most basic of tools. They had to set up on the island. John had experience, of course, he was a stocking maker, but it also meant that he could fix machinery. He was pretty handy. He'd also worked and labored on farms, so he was a pretty practical man. And he was able to, I guess he was fairly well equipped and skilled enough to be able to do all the building work that needed to be done. But it was such a different culture. Not only that, the lack of communication, the remoteness of the island, the climate, very different to Scotland. They were soon fighting with malaria and fevers and all of this type of difficulty. But they hung on there. And soon, in February of 1859, Mary actually gave birth to their firstborn child, a little boy, which they called Peter. This gave this young couple such joy. Finally, they were a family, and they were settling down on this island. And they, come what may, they were going to be ready. But very suddenly, Mary got a terrible fever. Of course, in those days, there was no medication. And John watched as, in a few weeks, she got weaker and weaker. And then she died. And then only less than 2 weeks later, the little baby boy died as well. And so, less than 6 months on this island, and John had to face the fact that he was completely alone now. What an introduction. The tragic loss of his wife and his firstborn son in a matter of weeks completely stunned John. He struggled to bury them. He covered their graves with white coral, and he would often just sit there and stare at the graves. And as he buried them, he prayed over and over again that this land in which he was burying his wife and his son would be claimed somehow for Jesus. But he really, really struggled with the loneliness. Now, other missionaries did come to visit him, but of course there was a time when he was on his own. The longer he stayed in Tanna, the more he understood about their customs and beliefs. And the more the novelty of his presence wore off. He was now subject to a lot more persecution. You see, his presence was often the scapegoat for everything. Something went wrong. One chief over there was sick. It was John's fault. There was a drought. It was John's fault. And people would have John in the middle of their conflicts. There would be conflict between tribes. John would be blamed. You know, he was often in the middle of all the difficulties that happened on the island, and often without realizing it. There were so many attempts on his life. In the case of the drought, he was blamed, and the inland chiefs called on the harbour chiefs and said, if you don't kill him now, we will kill him ourselves. But John would cry out to the Lord, and in the case of that particular drought, the Lord brought an abundance of rain, and so people allowed him to stay a little longer. There were so many attempts actually on his life that he would actually sleep in his clothes, so be ready to sort of jump up and run and escape or whatever. But soon he realized that this violence was not just towards the missionaries. Women were treated terribly. They were treated as slaves. On one occasion, a chief got sick, and so he ordered the sacrifice of three women so he could recover. They practiced infanticide. There was a man who got into an argument with his wife, and so he picked up the baby and killed it. Women were required to do all the work. They carried everything. They did all the everything, and they were just beaten just for trivial matters. If a woman died, no one took much notice. They also had the tradition that if a husband died, then the wife would also be strangled, which meant that there were children wandering everywhere, left to fend for themselves. If you were unable to work, if you were elderly or injured in some way, you were a burden, and so you're starved to death or buried alive so that you could get out of the way. Life for John and the Anyechimi's teachers on Tanna was so unpredictable. With the constant violence and being at the centre of all sorts of disasters and superstitions and so on, it meant that every day could bring the end of your life. But John really continued on. He saw that every day was another opportunity, that he was alive still. And he would speak the gospel to these people and try and show them and tell them of a new, completely different way. He would talk to them about Jehovah God, the living God. Soon there were people wanting to sort of visit the mission home. He actually ended up having to board up all the windows because people were so scared of being seen. They would come at night and they would only come in if everything was boarded up so no one could peep in. And John saw this as subtle change. There was interest. And in fact, you know, he could see that these people were desperate for some hope. Their lives had been driven by fear and fear of evil spirits and sorcery and witchcraft and violence. And here they'd heard for the first time of the resurrection from the dead. They'd heard of a God who hears. But it was such an uphill battle. One key thing that John had to contend with was the dishonesty of the people. Honesty wasn't seen as a virtue. You know, it was about what you could get away with. And so if there was something that John had that somebody else wanted, they would simply take it. And if John sort of made any squeak of opposition, they would put a musket to his head. Soon he found that he was losing tools all the time. In fact, he couldn't even leave his clothes and bed sheets and so on the line. They would be stolen. He had to watch them dry. He bought chickens off a man, and that night the chickens were stolen back. And he knew that if he went out, he would just be killed. There was actually a small shed that he'd built, and it was lockable. He could lock it. And he would put all his pots and buckets and things in there, all his tools, and lock it up. But soon that was, of course, broken into. And all his cooking utensils and buckets and pots were stolen, every single one. So he ended up with no linen for his bed, hardly any clothes left, no pots, not even a bucket to fill, to get water to supply. And he appealed to the chiefs, and they said, "Oh, we'll get the person who did this," but of course they did nothing. And so in desperation, John offered his last blanket to the person who could give him back his cooking pot. Well, he got back his cooking pot, minus the lid. That would have to be extra. John had a very strong bond with one particular Anyechimi's teacher who was there to help him. This man was Abraham and his wife. And this couple was such a help to John, particularly at this time. They helped him understand the language. They supported him in the daily work. You know, John was sick with fever, you know, malaria and such 14 times. And 14 times he thought he was going to die. And this faithful couple cared for him. They would carry him out of the hot mission house. They would lay him under the coconut trees. They would spoon the coconut water into his mouth. Time and time again, they defended him. This man, Abraham, would risk his own life to save John. And this really touched John. Abraham was so loyal. And this man had been a cannibal, just like the Tannese people, only years before. And to John, this was such a testimony of the power of salvation, that someone who had truly met God could be so utterly changed. John never ceased to be moved every time Abraham prayed for him, defended him, and assisted him so faithfully in the work. Now, there was a general hatred of all people who were white. And this was not unfounded. The white traders at this time were ruthless. They really took advantage of the native people. They encouraged war between the tribes. And they did this because they could sell gunpowder and they could make huge profits. They would strip the land of the sandalwood. They would steal the native women. They would kidnap young boys. They would lure them on to say, come and have a look at something on the ship, and then they would sail away with them as prisoner. And they would do this to keep them as slaves. But these traders too also experienced the violence as well. Many of them died as well from the tribes. But it meant that John had to work so hard to convince the people that he was not like them. He was not there for his own gain. He was there to teach them about Jehovah, the living God. He was there for more good than they could know. But it was hard because he was often tarred with the same brush. After years of hard labour on Tanna, day after day, risking his life and fearing death at every moment, only three or four people were attending his little service on a Sunday. In fact, there was increasing anger and opposition. John spent a day doing his usual thing, and a chief would come and hold a musket to his head and follow him around all day with it. That was sort of what was happening. People were incited by their chiefs to kill him, to threaten him, to take from him. But John had learnt by this point to give himself completely over to the Lord. And in some way, he felt that he was invincible. He knew that he was there for God's work. And so, if the Lord wanted him to live, then even if that musket was pointed to his head, or the killing stones were thrown, or the tomahawk was put to his neck, he knew that they wouldn't strike because the Lord would protect him if the Lord had work to be done on this island. And if not, then he would go because his work would be done. But during this time, he really hung on to these verses that Jesus spoke. He really held on to the verse, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age." And he wrote about this verse. He said, "Oh, precious promise, how often I adore Jesus for it and rejoice in it." Another Anetchimese teacher came from Anetchim to help him. This man was Namuri, was his name. And he decided to live in the next door village. He was going to set up a school there. You know, even living amongst these people and living just a normal life was itself a testimony. For Namuri, the way he treated his wife and respected her was shocking to the Tanese people. They didn't do that. They didn't treat their women like that. They could see his gentleness. It was so unusual. So even just living your normal daily life was such a testimony. And Namuri wanted to do that. But Namuri, of course, had enemies as well. And on one occasion, he was going about his daily business, and one of the Tanese chiefs, or one of the sacred men, came out with a killing stone and threw it at him. Namuri dodged this, but it hit his hand and cut him deeply, which meant that he wasn't able to run, and this particular sacred man jumped on him and clubbed him. Namuri was unconscious, but when he gained consciousness, he was able to crawl to the mission house, and he warned John that probably he would be next in line. Well, John saw the blood and the wounds and quickly bound it all up and cared for Namuri. And once Namuri was well enough to be able to walk and so on, he wanted to return. And John said, you can't go back. I think you should base yourself here. Just stay in the mission house. Don't go back. And Namuri replied, "Missy," that was the title they used for the missionaries, "Missy, when I see them thirsting for my blood, I see myself. When the missionaries first came to my island, I too desired to murder all of them. But had the missionaries stayed away from such danger, I would have remained a heathen. But he remained, and he continued to teach us. And by the grace of God, I am changed to what I am today." So off Namuri went, back to the village. And as he knelt in prayer the next Sunday, the same sacred man jumped out again with his club and clubbed him to death. And all the people gathered there, they didn't do anything. They didn't help him or stop him. They were afraid of the sacred man. And he was left for dead, but he wasn't dead. He was unconscious. And when he came to, he managed to crawl out and get some help. And John came to him and nursed him, but could see that the wounds were so bad that Namori was dying. And as John cradled him, Namori said, "Oh Lord Jesus, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And don't take your servants away from Tanner. Bring all the Tannies to live and follow Jesus." And then he died. And in John's own words, he wrote, "A great man has fallen in the service of Christ." One Sunday, three sacred men came to disturb the meeting. They had come to disrupt, to break it all apart. And these three particular sacred men had a huge influence across the village. They were really feared for their sorcery and witchcraft and skill. And they were very open in their opposition. They declared that they did not want to hear the name of Jehovah. They had no need for his help, and the name of Jehovah and this worship needed to be removed from the island. Well, John seized the opportunity, and he decided to directly challenge these three highly influential sacred men. Now, by this time, he had understood a lot of the customs, and he knew this one custom, this very powerful witchcraft that they believed in at the time, called Nahak. And this was where these witch doctors would take the half-eaten or leftover food of a person that they wanted to kill. They would take the half-eaten food, and through their sorcery and so on, they would bring torture and curses on the person who'd last eaten that food. It was such a feared sort of custom that the people would never leave leftovers in case a witch doctor could take it and then could actually use it against them. But here John grabbed three plums. And he got these three plums and he took a bite of each plum. And he handed those plums to each of the sacred men. And this was shocking, the idea that you would actually hand that half-eaten food to one of these men. And he said to them, "Do your worst. Go on. Call your evil spirits. Kill me. You have 1 week. No spears, no musket, no clubs, no tomahawk. Just your evil spirits, your gods, call upon them. 1 week you have, kill me." Well, the people were shocked at this, that John would bring this on himself. Well, the sorcerers, the sacred men, they grabbed these plums, and they wanted to do this. They wanted to rid the island of John Peyton and his teaching. And John said, "1 week, and we will see who is stronger. Is it Jehovah or is it your gods?" Well, the witch doctors started immediately and the people fled. But every day that week, people were watching. They were looking. They were wondering if John was going to fall sick, if he suddenly came up with a disease, or they would watch to see if he would just drop down dead. But by the next Sunday, he was fine. And he stood up that Sunday to a big crowd who had gathered to see. And he addressed the people again. "Friends," he said, "I've come to talk to you again about Jehovah God." Well, the three sacred men were there. And they had to admit that they had no power over that missionary. And they said, "It's because he too is a sacred man. And his God must have protected him." And John spoke out to the gathered crowds and said, "Yes, truly, my Jehovah God is stronger than your gods. And he is the only living and true God, the only God that can hear and answer." Well, two of those sacred men joined the rest of the village people under the tree to hear more of this Jehovah God. But the third man grabbed a spear. But everybody closed around John, protecting him. But John and the other Anachimes teachers escaped because they knew that there would be bloodshed. Now, more and more people were hearing the good news, the gospel. By now, about 116 people had heard something. Only about 30 were attending the worship, as they called it, on Sunday. And this was often in great peril to themselves. But as more and more interest was being stirred, more and more opposition as well was occurring. And the cry of "drive the worship of Jehovah out of our land" became increasingly heard. Chiefs were doing everything to get their people to kill anybody who associated with John. One night, John was asleep in the mission house. He was actually in a different part of the island. There were two other missionaries on the other side of the island, the Mathesons. They had run out of food. They had no supplies, and John had come to help them. They were also in great danger. And they'd all kind of come together in this mission house. And that night, John's faithful little dog started barking and pulling at his clothes. And so he woke up and he looked outside. And in the darkness, he could see sort of figures moving. And he knew that the house was being surrounded. And he quickly woke up everybody in the house. There were some Anachimes people there, the Mathesons. And he woke them up and said, "You know, they're surrounding the house. We've got to pray." And John said, "I'm going out to them." And the Matheson said, "Don't! You can't go out to them. You have to stay." And John said, no, "I'm going to go out." And before the Mathesons could even do anything, he'd gone out the door. And the Mathesons and the others just knelt in prayer. They didn't know what to do. As John went out, he could see in the distance some natives with fire torches. And he realized what they were planning. But the minute he was out there, seven or eight of them just grabbed him. They all had clubs. And he cried out to them and said, "You dare to strike me and Jehovah will punish you. My God is here. He will protect me." And they yelled back at him and they urged each other to kill. But not one of them struck. But by now, John could see that these people were coming with their flaming torches. And he could see what they were doing. There was a little church building where they used to gather next to the mission house. And already the flaming torches had been laid down and soon the flames were rising. And John could see that the wind was blowing directly towards that mission house where all the people were praying inside. And he could see that in moments the whole place would catch this. You know, these houses were built with palm leaves and thatch and stuff like this. It would just go off in seconds. And now the flames were leaping high into the air and he couldn't go anywhere. He was caught by the seven or eight men who were surrounding him. And then suddenly there was a loud roaring and he looked and everybody looked and a huge windstorm had blown up, almost like a tornado. And it was blowing the flames in the other direction, away from the mission house. And John watched in astonishment. And then on top of that, a huge storm broke. And this torrent, this downpour of rain, such that he had never even seen, even in the tropics, fell and the flames were out in no time. And he knew that the mission house was perfectly safe. Well, John dropped to his knees and the native people, they dropped their weapons and they ran. And they said, "This is Jehovah, this is Jehovah, and he is fighting for them. Get away." Well, John and the Mathesons and all the other people sheltering in that little mission house praised God. And Mr. Matheson said, "If ever in time of need God sent help and protection to his servants in answer to prayer, he has done so tonight." But the time had come for them to leave the island. They had been there, John had been there for 4 years. A very long, difficult 4 years. Mrs. Matheson was seriously unwell from malnutrition, exhaustion, and stress. And they were actually rescued off the island by a passing ship. On board the ship, John realized that all the crew were wearing his clothes. The Tannese people had stolen his clothes and sold it on to people, and the crew were wearing all his shirts. He actually had no clothing other than the clothing he was wearing. That's everything else had been stolen. And all he had was his translation work that he'd been working on and his Bible. Well, they managed to get to Aneityum, but Mrs. Matheson just got worse and she died soon afterwards. And her husband was so distraught at losing her that he too died shortly after. Now, John could see the needs. Firstly, they needed more people, more missionaries to come. There were so many islands and so many people who had never heard the gospel at all. And he really wanted to sort of get the word out there that more people needed to come. But very practically, he also realized that they needed their own ship. They could not rely on the white trader ships or the passing ships. And this was partly the problem. They couldn't even communicate between islands. It was difficult to get supplies. But the mission had no funding for a ship. But John thought that maybe he could raise some funds. If people knew what was happening in the situation, maybe they would help. So he went to Australia. In 1863, he landed in Sydney Harbour. He'd spent the voyage making another shirt. He landed in Sydney not knowing anybody, but he thought that at least maybe he could find a church there and speak to the Reverend, and maybe through that he would be able to start to tell people about what was happening not so far away from Australia. Well, he found a Presbyterian church not far from Sydney Harbour, and there was a kind man, a Reverend there, who heard him and said, "Please come and address the children." John spoke to the children, and then from there this man said, "Speak to the congregation this evening." And he told these people about what was happening in the New Hebrides and how they needed more people and how the gospel was starting to be spread, but still there was a harvest ready to be harvested. They needed workers. He also talked to them about the ship. Through this, more and more doors opened, and John soon found himself with a small network of the Christians in Australia at that time. But his introduction to Australia was quite interesting. Being from Scotland, he had no idea of the vastness of Australia, particularly at that time. 1860s, we don't have very many roads at this point in Australia. He was walking everywhere, and he was at a station, a farm station, and the people thought, "You're walking to your next place? Do you know how far that is?" By now he was sort of in the outback, outskirts of Sydney. He even travelled to Victoria as well. And the people said to him, the farm you're going to, that's a good 35 kilometres. You're not just going to walk there. Surely you're going to have a horse. Oh, of course, John said, no, it's fine, I'll just walk. But everybody in Australia had a horse. And so these kind brethren said, "Look, we'll give you a horse. You can ride it to the next place, and then we'll arrange with them. We'll pick up the horse later." And out of the kindness of their heart, they gave John their very best horse. Now, John didn't want to say anything, but he was terrified of horses. He was not a good horse rider. But they were so kind to do this, and he recognized it was a very long walk through the bush. And so he got on the horse and he started just on a very nice slow walk. What he didn't know was that the horse that they had so very kindly given him was a racehorse. He tried to get the horse to walk, but this horse was not used to walking. This horse also knew the road very well. He knew where it was headed. And so, after trying to just get this horse to move and just keep it a walk, the horse took off. And John could just hold on. He put his hat as firmly on his head as he could, and he just clung on for dear life. Mud was flying everywhere. He didn't even look. He had his eyes closed the entire time. He just clung onto those reins and just hoped that the horse was going in the right direction. And the horse did. It flew. It flew down that road, and it tore through the bush, and John just could do anything to just try and hold on to those reins. And as he neared the farm station where he was headed to, you know, the people looked out and they could see this familiar horse tearing down the road, and they thought, what's going on? So the farmer ran and flung open the gate, and the horse tore through the gate, and then the farmer rushed and tried to grab the reins to steady the horse, and the horse stopped abruptly at the stables, almost throwing John off. Well, John was still holding on with his eyes closed, clinging to the reins. And the whole family had gathered on the veranda to look. And they thought, is this the guy? The great missionary? John slid off the saddle and fell to the ground. He was still curled in a ball. They tried to speak to him, but he was in so much shock that he couldn't even string a sentence together. And then he tried to get up and just fell over again because his legs were like jelly. And then the farmer thought, oh no. The man's drunk. And then they thought, what am I going to do? We've arranged all those meetings. The man's a fraud. He's a drunk. And John, finally, they had to carry him into the farmhouse. And then later, as they gave him some tea, and they were wondering what on earth they were going to do with this drunk, he finally came to. He was able to put a sentence together. And he said, I don't ride horses. And then they understood. Yes. So that was his introduction to Australia. But his time in Australia was quite fruitful. And in fact, the news of the work in the New Hebrides spread. And much money was raised. Enough, in fact, to build a ship. And build a ship they did. And they called it the Dayspring. From here, John returned to Scotland. And he also talked about the mission work that he was doing in the New Hebrides, and explained to the New Hebrides mission all that had been happening, and urged people, he encouraged people to really think about coming, and that they needed more people. There was so much work to be done. During these years in Scotland, he also married a lady by the name of Margaret, who became well known as Maggie. He also spent time with his parents. And on that last day with his parents, his father, now a venerable old man with white hair, you know, again, this father in tears, prayed for his son and his wife. And John left again from his home, asking the Lord for a double portion of the spirit of his father and mother. And he had a sense that this would be the last time that he would see them on earth. The little ship, the Dayspring, had set off on its maiden voyage, and on board were three new missionaries heading for the New Hebrides. It was 1866 now. John was 42 years old, and now he was the first missionary appointed and supported from Australia. He went back and landed in Inyatium again, which was still, of course, the base for all the missionary activity. And it was there that he learnt that his faithful, dear brother Abraham had passed away during his time in Scotland. John had given Abraham a silver watch, a watch that he'd got him in Sydney, actually. And Abraham had left this watch to John with a little message. He said, "Give this to Missy, my own Missy Payton, and tell him that I go to Jesus, and there, time is dead." It was thought best that John not go to Tanna, where he intended to go. He wanted to go back there. But the brethren there thought that no, he would go to Aniwa. This was a neighbouring island to Tanna, actually. And they actually had to harbour in Tanna and then take a smaller ship over to Aniwa. Now, when the old chief of Tanna looked and saw that John was returning, he was so shocked. This wily old chief had not been very good to John in those 4 years on Tanna. But to see the man come back That was quite something. He actually begged John to come back and stay on Tanna. But when it was clear that John was going to Aniwa, well, this man, this chief, he turned to the chief of Aniwa, who was visiting at that time, and he took off his armband and he said to that chief, "By this, you are bound to protect this Missy and his wife on Aniwa. If you let evil come to them, my people will revenge it." Well, little did John know that that little passing of the armband saved their lives on many occasions. The island of Aniwa was very small compared to Tanna. And some of the Anetchumi's brethren had been there already and had started building, and they built a little mission house there, even started a little school and so on. But again, you know, John and his wife had the huge task of learning the language again, the Aniwan language, and of course, you know, building and doing all those things. Now, because John understood something of the culture, one thing he wanted to build was orphanages. Just like on Tanna and on Iwa, they had the custom of, you know, if the husband died, then you strangled the wife. And so, of course, there were so many orphans. And so John wanted to do something to care for these children. Now, one particular chieftain on Aniwa took a lot of interest in the Paytons. At first, this was completely self-interest. You see, he had seen already the boxes of calico, the fish hooks, the knives, the blankets, all of these things being unloaded from the ship. And he coveted these items, and so did everyone else on the island. They knew also, well, he knew, white people were stupid. They were so easily fooled. So the chief sold them at a very good price some land. This land was land that no one on the island could use. It was cursed. They had something buried there or something. And so they wouldn't even farm this land. In fact, it was told that if you ate anything that grew from the soil of this land, then you would die. Nobody lived anywhere near it. So they sold that piece of land to the missionary. The plan was, as this chief decided, was that the missionaries would build there, they would, you know, have farm there, etc., and then they would die and leave all their stuff, and it would be distributed on the island. But Chief Namaki, he watched, and the Paytons weren't dying, they were thriving, and then Namaki started hearing them talk about Jehovah God, their God, a different god to the gods they were used to. And then he started to wonder whether this Jehovah was in fact stronger than the spirits of the island. Now, the Sunday meetings were soon in full swing, but it was a fairly sorry sight. Well, for Peyton at least, that's what he felt. You see, people would come to the Sunday meeting armed. And most people would come, sometimes they would come to sell things, sometimes they would come to sleep, to smoke, to talk with each other and carry on. There was no listening to the white guy. Some of them came actually expecting to be paid. But gradually, regardless, people were hearing the gospel and they were being introduced for the very first time to Jehovah God. Although changes were slow, there was one key event. And it was this one event that broke the darkness of Aniwa. This island had a problem with water supply. They depended on rainwater, but there were times of drought where the rain didn't fall. And in those times, the people actually had to depend on the water, that the only water they had was the water from the coconuts. John knew that the people would really benefit from a well. And he decided to ask the Lord to help him, to lead him, to know how to dig and where to dig a well. He had no experience at all in this. He had no idea how to, you know, sink a well and where would be best, where would you find fresh water, etc. But he asked the Lord to show him. And he gathered the chiefs one day and he told them that he planned to do this. He planned to dig a huge hole so that they could have water. Well, they all laughed at him. "Water comes from above, don't you know, not from the ground." They thought he was mad. And he did certainly look mad there in the tropical sun, starting to dig a hole next to the public thoroughfare with his little pickaxe. and people gathered to laugh at him. And it was terribly hard work, and he was there struggling and working and thirsty, and he didn't even know if he was digging in the right spot. But he trusted that the Lord would provide. He soon tried to pay people in fish hooks to help him dig. 12 feet, and the side caved in. And then none of the natives wanted to help because they thought that, you know, it's dangerous. They could have got buried alive. And so he was on his own again, digging day after day. 30 feet down, and the phrase from the scripture, living water, kept playing in his mind. He kept going, and finally he felt damp under his feet. And he thought, yes, the Lord's answering my prayer. And he called the chiefs together and he said, tomorrow we will have water. Well, at this rate, the natives thought that he was going to drop into the sea. That's how big this hole was. And John himself was really nervous. You know, this was a powerful testimony. He could see that. But what happens if the water was salt water? And what happens if there actually wasn't any water? It was just damp. And he did have many doubts. But at dawn, he was down in that hole, and he dug a small sort of narrow hole deeper, and it filled with water. And he scooped it up, a bit of muddy water, and tasted it. Fresh. Well, by then, the chiefs had gathered, and people were gathering around. The villagers had come. They saw that he was working. And in the presence of them all, he went down into the well with an empty jug, and he filled it up with the water that had started to bubble at the bottom of the well. And he brought it up, and Chief Namaki tasted it, and he cried out, "It's rain! Rain from below!" And the chief said, "No god of Aniwa has ever helped us in this way. The world has been turned upside down since Jehovah came to Aniwa." Well, John declared this Jehovah's well, and it would be shared to all. There would be no payment. Everyone had access to this well. And John was exhausted. And Namaki now felt ashamed that they had done nothing and just laughed. And so he called the people and he called the other chiefs and said, "No one will sleep until we finish this well. And Missy Payton, he is now to rest." And so they stabilized the whole well with huge blocks of coral, and they finished it off. There was already such a change in these people. But since that time, the Aniwans have tried to sink 6 or 7 wells at other points of the island. And every other well that they've tried to sink has produced salty water. And they would say, "Well, we have learnt to dig, but not to pray like Missy Payton." That next Sunday, Chief Namaki asked John if he could speak to the people. John agreed, of course. And he arrived in all his finery, brandishing his tomahawk. And he stood in front of the assembled gathering and he said, "From this day, I believe all that Missy Payton tells us about his Jehovah God. Someday, all our eyes will see it. For today we have seen rain from the earth. Something in my heart tells me that the Jehovah God does exist, the invisible one, whom we have never heard of nor saw until Missy brought him to our knowledge. Henceforth, I am a follower of Jehovah God. Let us be taught by Missy how to serve the God that hears, the Jehovah who gave us this well and will give us every other blessing, for he sent his son Jesus to die for us and bring us to heaven. Namaki stands for Jehovah." Well, that afternoon, the old chief brought out all his idols and charms and threw them down at the mission house. More and more people did the same, and soon a great fire was burning as they burnt all these charms and all these idols, and anything that wasn't burnt was thrown into the sea. Light had come to Aniwa. But so much had to change, and so much did change. They had to change all the social laws. No more revenge killings. No more clubs. No more retaliation. Instead, they had fines. They had lashings. They declared a day for Jehovah. Generally, industry increased and people started caring for each other, which was so contrary to how they had been living before. You know, the man who had grabbed his newborn baby in an argument with his wife and killed it was now helping to care for the orphans. But Peyton had to make it very clear to the chiefs that coming to worship Jehovah was an individual choice, and you cannot enforce that. And he made that really, really clear to the people. And you can imagine his joy on that first baptism and for the first time when they broke bread together on the island of Aniwa. During all this time, John and his wife were working on translating portions of the New Testament in the Aniwan language. This was eagerly monitored by Chief Namaki. And finally, a short passage of the scriptures were ready, and John had a printing press. And Namaki was eagerly watching all of this process, and he grabbed the finished copy. He knew that this was God's word for the first time in his language, and he grabbed it. And then was sadly disappointed. He said, "What is this? It's just blur." And John realized that the poor man had very bad eyesight. And so he lent him some spectacles. And Namaki said, "What is this? You have healed the blind." And he looked and he could see words on the page. And he cried out and he said, "The word of Jesus has now come to Aniwa." But the poor man couldn't read. So he decided that he would learn. And so he started drawing the letters in the dust. And soon he'd mastered the alphabet and he started to spell out the Aniwan words. He would recognize it, he would read it, he would memorize them. Any young person that walked past, he would call them over and read to them. And he said, "See, the book speaks our language." Namaki's wife was a little more reluctant. But it was Mrs. Peyton who had translated some hymns and would sing and play the harmonium. She drew Namaki's wife. And soon both the chief and his wife were learning to read so that they could hear the words of Jesus speak to them. Now, the work of the Lord on Aniwa and for many years earlier on Aneptium had a huge impact on the whole of the New Hebrides. You see, every new convert became a missionary. You know, the way they lived and their daily life in their villages and so on was already a testimony. They were living so differently to the people around them. The fact that chiefs would go and approach another tribe without weapons, that was very significant and spoke very loudly. There were times when another tribe would throw spears and the other tribe wouldn't retaliate. And this made people wonder what had happened, what had changed. There was a young chief, a very intelligent man by the name of Naswai. He learnt to read and write very quickly. And he became an elder in the church, and soon he was able to preach. And he was able to draw examples from island life to really help the people. When the Aniwans travelled to another island, they would always talk about Jehovah. On one occasion, one of the chiefs stood up and he spoke to the assembled company there and he said, "What is Christianity?" "Well, it is that which has changed the people of Aniwa." Peyton worked on Aniwa for close to 30 years, but during that time he also had to travel. The Dayspring ship, which had been so useful to them, had been wrecked in a storm. They needed to raise more funds. He had to travel again to Australia and then back to Britain to tell again of the work that had been done to raise more funds for another ship for the mission. But in all of this time, he'd never forgotten Tanner. And just before his 71st birthday, he sailed again to the islands, and this time to Tanner. But he wasn't alone. This time his son came with him, Frank. And Frank, too, had grown up on Aniwa, and he wanted as well to be a missionary, and he wanted to go to Tanna. And the people did receive Frank and his wife. They were more gracious. And John could see that the Lord had been working somehow on that particular island. A few years later, in 1897, and John had finished the New Testament, translated into the Aniwan language. And he made another journey to Aniwa to stay there so he could deliver the New Testament to them, the completed New Testament. And he stayed on this island to teach them, to go through it, to read it with them. And there, Frank had been on Tanna for 3 years now. And such a change had happened already. And I mean, John noticed it immediately. Because when he landed and all the people gathered to see the ship, only one chief was armed with a rifle. And it was 1899 now, and there were now 5 Aniwan families who had moved to Tanna so that they could bring light to their neighbours. John Peyton was determined to work until his dying day. He was now an older, frailer man in his 70s, but he was determined again with his wife, Maggie, that they wanted again to see their people on Aniwa. This was no tropical holiday. The mosquitoes, the food, the difficulty of the climate, the damp, made it not a particularly appropriate place for the elderly. But the Peytons were so determined, and such was their love for these people. In fact, when they landed on the island, the whole island gathered together, except for one man who was far away on a fishing trip. And all of them gathered to welcome John and Maggie. To them, to the island, this was their father and mother, their spiritual father and mother. And what joy for John and Maggie to see when they arrived on this island that all the children could read and write, that the schools were still functioning, the elders had been teaching the people, that families had gone out to neighbouring islands to bring the gospel to their people, their neighbours. But Mrs. Peyton was soon struggling with illness. And so they couldn't live on Aniwa for too much longer. John wanted to take her to Australia so she could recover. But Mrs. Peyton knew that that would be the last time she would see her beloved family on Aniwa. Back in Victoria now, and Margaret's health was failing. So was John's. He was an old man now. His memory was starting to fade. Margaret died in May of 1905. And John felt the loneliness very, very keenly. They had laboured together for some 40 years. But he didn't want to stop. He was so weak now that, you know, when he spoke, he had to be lifted to the pulpit. But even as an old man, he continued to preach. And his last ever sermon, he was lifted to the pulpit and he preached for almost an hour, pleading again with the people to remember the lost, to remember those who had never heard the gospel and had no means of hearing it. But he was very ill now, and his children came. Some of them were based in Australia. His son Frank came to be with him, and it was his son Frank that was by his bedside as John prayed fervently for his children and his grandchildren, that no one would be a wanting and all would be gathered home to glory. On Monday the 28th of January 1907, John Peyton slipped into eternity. At last, he could rest. He was buried in a cemetery in Kew in Victoria, aged 83. John's fervent desire for most of his life was that everybody on the New Hebrides would hear the gospel. In fact, during his lifetime, he raised so much awareness of what was going on there. More and more missionaries had come out. And even during his lifetime, 25 of the 30 islands, the largest islands, had missionaries based there. And more people saw the need. More and more people were inspired to go to far-flung regions of the earth at that time to witness to the Lord Jesus, to spread the gospel. But also, about a tenth of the population of Aniwa went out as teachers and missionaries to all those other islands in the New Hebrides. And today, the New Hebrides, which is known as Vanuatu, is known as a Christian nation. 83% of the population identifies as Christian. This dear brother with such an evangelist's heart. He labored tirelessly for the gospel, and he experienced some marvelous things in his life over and over again. He experienced the power of God, the grace of God, and the comfort of the Lord Jesus. But all this time, he also recalled the wisdom of his mother, spoken some 70 years before. In his older years, he wrote, "This is strength. This is peace. To feel in entering on every day that all its duties and trials have been committed to the Lord Jesus, and that come what may, he will use us for his own glory and our real good."
Thank you, Michelle, for this wonderful biography. And let's sing. Let Your Kingdom Come, 142.
Your sovereign work on earth is done.
Thank you. Please be seated. A few announcements. First of all, is the weekend away, which is on the 10th of December to the 12th of December. I hope you have registered if you are planning to go. But this weekend away